Ruth chapter 2, verse 1 to 13. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers." So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants."
Well, good morning, everyone, and great to see all of you on another very chilly day. And I hope the Book of Ruth is open in front of you, because I think this will really warm your heart. So I'm going to pray, and then we'll jump right in. So we're in our third of Ruth at the moment, so let's pray. Father, we want to ask one thing this morning. Will you just help us to see what is true? Help us to see things as they really are. Help this text in front of us, which was written by the Holy Spirit, help us this text to open our eyes to see clearly. And if you're very kind, can we see like you? Can we judge the world the way you judge the world, please? And that would be for our incredible joy and encouragement. And it'll be to your great honor and glory. Amen. So as you heard, I just prayed. How do you see things? How's your eyes this morning? You can tell I've got a pulpit which is a bit taller, so that says something about my eyes. But how do you see things? Really, if I had a glass here, here is a glass, and the liquid came up halfway, how would you see it? Would you see it as being half empty, or would you see it as being half full? How do you see things? Let me give you an illustration of a man who saw things a certain way. So there's this guy, right? And he's involved in a horrible car accident. And he ends up being in a coma for 6 months. And he's in bed in his coma in the hospital. And one morning, he wakes up. He starts seeing for the first time in a long time. And he looks up and there's his wife sitting right at the foot of the bed knitting or whatever. And he looks up and he says, "Darling, You've been here the whole time. Yes, dear. Have you been with me this whole time? Yes, dear. Wow. You know, I'm starting to see things. I think I can see something. What, darling? She says, you know, you've always been with me. You always there. When I had that car accident, you were with me. You know, do you remember when I was retrenched from work? You were with me the whole time. Do you remember when we lost our house because we went bankrupt? You know, you were with me the whole time. Do you remember that bout of cancer I had? You stood by me the whole way. You were always with me. Remember the home invasion and those guys who came and took it? You were with me. You stood by my side. I've started to realize something. She leans forward. Yes, dear. And she says, I've decided. I can see it now. You bring me bad luck. No. The reason I start like that is because it's about two things. It's about how you see things, how you interpret things, and it's also about a thing called luck. Because here is a man who interprets the data of life through a certain lens. He sees this thing called luck, which you get good of and you get bad of, and he interprets everything through that grid. Because here's the point. The way you see things, how you see things, will show what your heart is like. The way you see things will be your state of mind. Everything depends on how you see things. Psychologists know this. This whole cognitive restructuring, it's all about trying to get you to see things in a certain way. Because if you see things in a certain way, it affects every part of you, the way you see things. Jesus said the same thing. Look at something Jesus said in Matthew 6. Jesus said this, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. What's going on inside will depend on how you see things. If your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. And if then the light in you is in darkness, how great is that darkness? What Jesus is saying is that the state of your heart, your hopes, your dreams, your joy, your depression, your fear, your worry, your energy, all of that will depend on how you see things. How do you see things? So look at a glass. It's got liquid up halfway. How should Christians view that? Is it half full or is it half empty? How should Christians see things? How should we see things? I think you've got two options. Your one option is like the story, which is why I told it. Luck. Perhaps you look at the world as you wake up in the morning and it really is random. It's like Shakespeare said, the arrows and slings, or slings and arrows, I don't know if I can go first, of outrageous fortune. It's random. It's willy-nilly. No one actually knows. No one's in charge. No one's driving it because, hey, you know, bad things happen, you know? It can happen and it doesn't happen. It's all luck. No one's actually ruling. Oh, maybe there's a God. But he's not allowed to interfere, okay? And so it's all random. That's one way of seeing things. The other way of seeing things is what Jesus says. Jesus says that there is a sovereign God who is actually ruling. He's not a titular figure. He's actually ruling. In control of everything. He is directing the traffic completely. In fact, Jesus says it's down to the minutest detail. Jesus says, we're sitting here today in Yangchep in the park. A little sparrow has just died. I'm sorry to inform you of that. Jesus said God was in control of that little sparrow. God was in control. You look at the hairs on your head. This is Jesus' example. He says that the hairs on your head are numbered. He's not saying God can count, because how mundane is that? So can I. What he's saying is, you've got the right amount of hairs on your head because God determined it. It was something I'll take up with him. It's all completely under his control. Here's what you can't do. There's a hybrid. I'm going to invent a new phrase today. It's called jack-in-the-box theology. And this is what modern Christianity is infected with. God is like a jack-in-the-box. He's in this box and he's stuck there. But luckily, every now and then he pops up. It's so exciting when a leg grows longer or something happens. Then God pops up like a jack-in-the-box. But most of the time he's hidden in this little box. And you only see him when he pops up. It's called a jack-in-the-box theology. So here's how it works. You wake up at 6 in the morning. Oh, yeah, it's Sunday morning, you've got to get to church, stretch, you go over, you get dressed, you brush your teeth, you wake the children up for the 10th time, you drag everybody, you stuff them in the car, she's still eating her Wheaties in the back seat, and off you get to church, and you're feeling miserable. It's a horrible planet, really. You get to church, and the music's not bad. There's a couple of friendly people. And there's a great verse on, and the next thing you're feeling it. And suddenly, guess what? God shows up. God arrives, and you're there in his presence. What a morning. That is a horrible way to look at the world. Because God, let me help you. God never shows up. Get that. God never shows up. Because God never leaves. He was always there. What happened to the 3 hours before you got to church? He was there as much as he was in church. When you woke up, who was controlling the Milky Way? When you went and turned on the tap and water came out, who made sure there's water? Or when you ate your Wheaties, who put water in the wheat belt for you? Who gave you money? Who gave you the health? You got out of bed and your heart went, doo-doo-doo. Who did that? And then you stuffed the kiddies and brought them along. But who did, you know, all the way to God was always there. It's not that he showed up. It's that you woke up to reality. You started to see the way it was always. In fact, before you were born, God was there. Do you know that your mum, when she was pregnant, was nearly killed by a drunk driver? You don't know this because she's never told you. The reason she's never told you is because she doesn't know it either. Nobody knows it. But it happened. But God was there. You were a baby and he was protecting you long before you were born. This is the truth about God. And this is what the book of Ruth is going to teach us this morning. This morning we are going to see it so clearly that when we look at a glass, and it's like, so how should a Christian see it? There's a glass. Is it half full or is it half empty? By the end of this morning, if you listen to the book of Ruth, this is the way you're going to see it. It's full. It's flowing over. It's pouring out. It's a fountain of providential grace and care in everything. We're going to see that in the book of Ruth. We've got one point this morning. Here's our point for this morning. For those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. Let me show it to you in the life of this woman, Ruth and Naomi. Look at verse 1, chapter 2, verse 1. Watch this. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Oh, lucky for some. It just so happens she's got a relative who's pretty powerful. How lucky is that? Some people, I don't have any nice relatives. She's just so lucky. Well, actually, the word relative, not quite. It probably more like friend, probably more like connection, acquaintance, but relative's fine. Anyway, the point is that it just so happens, would you believe it, that she's got this connection. In fact, there's two wonderful contrasts in this verse. Contrast, look at it there, it's so brilliantly written. A relative of her husband's, comma, a worthy man. There's your first contrast. You've got Elimelech, who we know is unworthy. This is the dude who turned his back on God, led his family up the garden path. Right next to this unworthy fellow is a worthy man. Wonderful contrast there for you. But it's not just that, there's another contrast. What you've got here is an empty Naomi. We know this from last week. Naomi is empty. She ain't got nothing going for her. She's been stripped of everything. And here is a worthy man. The word worthy means rich, powerful, influential, a shaker and a mover. This man ain't empty. He's full. He's got it all. So you've got this beautiful contrast right there in verse 1. And I just can't help thinking, have you got connections like this? Have you got friends in high places? I'm telling you, you're not going to make it. Not in Australia. No, wait. Not anywhere. You're not going to make it unless you've got connections in high places. And Jesus wants to be your friend. He is the rich man. In fact, for your sakes, he became poor so that he could become rich, so that you could draw from his riches. Everything you don't have, he's got. You're in a better position than Naomi. But Naomi has got this connection. So there's some hope, I suppose. Watch what happens in verse 2. And so Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I find grace or favor." Same word. And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." Now this is Old Testament Centrelink. This is how Centrelink works in the Old Testament. When you do your fields, you don't kill it. You don't, I mean, what a foreign concept is this? You don't maximize profit. That's what you don't do. Because if you leave a little bit behind as you're gleaning in your fields, then the poor people, they can come behind and pick up the little bits you left over. Centrelink in the Old Testament. The problem is, look at verse 2. Ruth the Moabite. There's a problem. Centrelink's only if you've got your permanent residency. Centrelink is for citizens. It's not for foreigners, not for illegal aliens. And this is what Ruth is. She's a foreigner. And Centrelink, well, the gleaning process, not really for, I suppose we want to be kind to foreigners in the Old Testament, but it's not really for them. And especially not for Moabites. That's like someone from ISIS coming to Australia and signing on in Centrelink. Would you be happy with that? Well, that's what's going on here. Ruth is a Moabite. The Israelites and the Moabites were always killing each other. And she's going to come live off our stuff? It's not for her. It's remarkable to me how love has reduced Ruth to such poverty. She's clung to Naomi. And it's cost her. In fact, it's made her a beggar. It's made her stand in a queue at Centrelink. Had she been back in Moab, she wouldn't be able to do this. And yet, this is the path she's chosen. And she's looking for grace. Look what she says there. "I'll go glean after him who, in whose sight I find grace." She's off to look for grace. This is the life of faith. Is that it puts you in a position of a beggar so that you go seeking grace. She wouldn't need that if she stayed in Moab. She'd be rich and she wouldn't need grace. She needs it here. But I love the way it's active. Depend. I'm off to glean. Why are you going? After someone who will show me grace. Friends, that's how you seek for grace. That's how you depend on God. It's an active depend. Ruth doesn't go, "Dear Lord Jesus, give me today my daily bread." Flop on the couch, home and away. You know, I'm just waiting for Jesus to do something. She goes seeking grace. It's an active dependence. Now watch what God does. Look with me from verse 3. "So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers." And you're never going to believe this. "And she happened," I mean, what are the chances? Such lucky for some. "And she just so happened," or if you want to take it literally from the Hebrew, "as luck would have it." There's the word luck. "As luck would have it, she came to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech." What a lucky thing to have happened. Is that how you see it? Is that how you're seeing it unfold? Lucky for her. What are the chances of all the fields? Well, actually it gets better. Because look at verse 4. "And behold," oh, Now you're really not going to believe it. On top of that, would you believe it? Behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. On the day that she goes to look for grace, she stumbles onto the right field, belongs to Boaz, and would you believe it? On that day, Boaz has left all the other businesses, and he's come down to check on this field. What a coinkydink. Lucky for some. Or, is there an author? Could it be that this is being orchestrated? How do you see things? How do you see things? Is there someone driving the bus, do you think? The word I want to introduce you to is a word that we don't often use, but we must hold on to it. Providence. That's what's going on here. Providence. There's no better word to describe it. The word providence simply means this. Everything that happens is God at work. Let me say that again. Everything that happens, except for the parts where the devil jumps in, is God at work. No. Everything that happens, bar nothing, is God at work. It's called providence. Let me try and teach you a couple of things about providence. Number one, you can't grasp it. Your head is not big enough to put all the so you're working on your computer. And you're looking at the screen. And a fly comes in. And it lands on your keyboard. What does the fly see? He sees the letter L. That's all he sees. In fact, he can't even see. He doesn't even know it's the letter L. He's licking it. He's trying to see, does it taste good? The fly has got no concept. This is the letter L. This is a keyboard. This is connected to a huge machine humming under the desk. This is connected to a world wide web. There's somebody watching me with a fly swatter. He sees none of that. He's licking the keyboard. You and I are less than that fly. We can't see how it's connected. We can't see how it's wired. We can't see we're on the letter L. We think our life is all that there is. It's not. It's all part of the world wide web. More than that, there's somebody watching us. We can't see it, but there's somebody watching us. But he doesn't have a fly swatter. We see pieces, but we don't see the whole puzzle. That's providence. You can't see it all. But you know what that verse tells me? I can't see all the pieces, but I can see the puzzle maker. And if I love the puzzle maker, then he is in control putting the pieces together. But the fourth thing about providence, and I think the most important thing, providence happens in ordinary life. Can I say that again? Providence is God at work in everything in ordinary life. Watch Ruth. Ruth decides, I'm going to go glean today. Off she goes. Suddenly, the voice says, Ruth, Ruth, go to that field. No, none of that. No one tells her where to go. She's, that looks like a good field. I'll try that one. Ruth goes to the field and she's working hard. Ooh, look at this piece of paper. It's the winning lottery ticket. Doesn't happen. Suddenly her teeth turn to gold. Gold dust starts falling from the sky. There's a chorus of angels. No, there's nobody walking on water here. There's no water turning into wine here. No, it's ordinary life. She sweats all day. She labors. Her back is killing her. She grunts. She's tired. She's scrounging. Her fingernails will never come right. There is soil in every single one of them. She's thinking, God, please help me. Where are you when I need you? And she's, that's ordinary life. And God is watching. And he's driving the bus. And he's in control. And I can't see him. But he's watching me. He's looking. In fact, I'll show it to you. Watch how God is watching. Look at verse 5. Then Boaz said to his young men, who's in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? He's watching. God sees everything all the time through this man. She's been noticed. And look at verse 5. Who is this young woman? It's not, hello, hello. Who's this young woman? What catches Boaz's eye? What draws his attention? Look at Ruth. She's having a bad hair day. She's wearing tracky dacks. Naomi told her not to wear that, but she said, I'm going to be on my knees all day. She's sweating. She's covered in dirt. She's not lounging on a suntanning in a bikini. And Boaz goes, who's that young lady? No, no. She's working hard. Boaz sees character. He sees as God sees. Look at this verse here. How do you see things, men? Men, how do you see things? Look at this. We're studying this in the growth groups, by the way. If you're in a growth group, you'll look quite a bit of time on this verse. Do not let your adorning be external. The braiding of hair, the putting on of gold jewelry, or the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle, quiet spirit, which is in God's sight very bad. And men are reading that and they're going, I don't want to marry a librarian. You know, I don't go to the library to pick up chicks. You know, my apologies if you're a librarian. What is the gentle, quiet spirit? I'm not into that. Boaz was into that. Because men, when will you learn to see the way God sees? Look at what God finds attractive. Look what draws his attention. He sees the inside, the gentle, quiet spirits, two things which girls are told never to be in our society. That's what turns God on. That's what he's attracted to. Men, we need to learn to see the way God sees. And women, well, it's actually addressed to women. What are you trying to attract? What are you trying to do with your 4 hours every morning at the gym? Who are you trying to, whose attention are you trying to draw? There's a wonderful story in here for us. Learning to see the way God sees. To see that the way Ruth lives is what attracts God and attracts the right men. And I guess that's the story here. You've got a godly, good man who's attracted to the right things. And you've got a faithful, sacrificial, faithful, hardworking person looking for grace. And here's the question. How will they come together? E-harmony. No. Who will bring these two together? And the answer is providence. It is God who connects these things. Who will connect you to the man of your life? Your redeemer. I'm not talking to the women. I'm talking to men and women. Who will put you in touch with the one who is rich where you're poor? Who will put you in touch to the one who is strong where you're weak? Who will put you in connection with one who has everything when you have nothing? The answer is, well, providence. The truth of the matter is, I don't know what providence is at work at your life, but I know one thing. It just so happens that on the 6th of August, you're sitting here today. And you're hearing Boaz. For God is our Boaz. He is our better than Boaz. And today, just so happens, would you believe it, you happened not to go to the beach, and it's a good day for not going to the beach, and you're sitting here. That's providence. And if you're here this morning and you're waiting for flash bang, ain't going to happen. I'm telling you, it's never going to happen. I don't think you'll ever see a miracle in this church like that. Ever. But providence has drawn you. How do you see things? How do you see things? Well, the story has a big movement, and here's the second half of this morning. There's a huge movement in this story because in verse 8, you have this moment where boy meets girl. That's always a huge moment in any story. Boy meets girl. Verse 8, watch what happens. So then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one. Keep close to my young women. I'm blown away by that address. Now listen, my daughter. I'm blown away by the overtures of grace. This is a foreigner. This is an outsider. He's got lots of other young women, as you can see. But he turns to her and he says, my daughter, there's grace on offer. But the thing I really love is the platonic purity that exudes from this powerful man. He looks at her, he doesn't say, ooh, so what's a pretty little thing like you doing in a field like this? There's not a hint. It's just so pure. Because Boaz sees things in a certain way. He doesn't look at a woman and think, me. He doesn't look at here is a vulnerable young widow in his field. Man, she'll do anything for $500, don't you? Doesn't enter his mind. He will not. He thinks when he sees what? When he looks at a woman, what does he see? Platonic daughter. This is the way Christians are to see when they see women. The book of 1 Timothy tells us, treat women as sisters in all purity. It's such a challenge to us today. Are women safe around you? In your presence, men, in the culture of domestic violence and predatoriness on women, when women are around you, do they feel safe? In fact, the guy's got a reputation. Look at the end of verse 8. Keep close to what? My young women. This guy is so pure that women are attracted to him. He's got a horde of them because they feel safe. We work our level best at North Coast Church to create an environment where women feel utterly safe. These are men that haven't even thought of taking advantage of me. How do you see things, men? When you see a woman, what do you see? Do you see a daughter? Do you see a sister in Christ? Or do you see potential? But, oh, I'm married. Oh, so much potential. But it's all unrealized because I'm married and I'm stuck. I wouldn't do anything. But, gee, I wish I could. Or do you see them in absolute purity? In our society, women are safe with gay men. And the rest are up for grabs. Really? And then look what he does, verse 9. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping. Go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? When you're thirsty, go to the vessels. Drink what the young men have drawn. What does he give her? He gives her welcome. He gives her provision. He gives her protection. He gives her community. He gives her asylum. Here is an asylum giver. She's an asylum seeker. He is an asylum giver. Here is a man, and you can see where this is going. We need to find a man like this who will give us the asylum that our hearts are so desperate to find. He gives a welcome, provision, protection, community. And then verse 10, she falls on her face. She fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him this great question. Why? Why? Why have I found grace in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? Why? Why have you been so good to me? Friends, on the one hand, we're just going to bash a girl. Verse 2, you asked for this. You prayed. In verse 2, you went off looking for the person who would give you grace. Now you find it. Now you're saying, why? But isn't that exactly how good grace is? Isn't it amazing? When you ask God for grace and he gives it to you, you end up going, why? But that's how refreshing, that's how beautiful a thing grace is. Every Christian who's ever been graced never stops going, why? Why? It's the natural. In fact, we sing songs about that one word. I cannot tell why he whom angels worship should set his love on the children of men. There's one for you. I only know the old ones. I know not why God's wondrous love to me has been made known. Christians sing that word, why? Because grace is so much better. If you deserved it, you would never ask why. But that's what grace does. It brings you to fall down like Ruth and go, why? Or modern, I've got to give a modern one. What's a modern one? I wrote one down. Why should I gain from his reward? I cannot tell. Why? Well, I'll tell you why. The answer's there. Because Boaz is just that kind of guy. That's why. That's what it is. The answer is not in yourself. It's in Boaz. Look what she says there in verse 10. She fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said, why have I, as in, I don't deserve this, found grace in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner? But Boaz answered her and said, all that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been told to me, how you left your father, mother, and your native land to come to a people that you did not know before. The answer lies in Boaz. He's just that nice. Friends, our Boaz is better than this one. Our Boaz is better than this one. Look on the screen. He says, daughter, look what our Boaz does for us. See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called sons and daughters, children of God. And so we are. Our Boaz has been better. In fact, in the growth groups, we're studying that this Boaz is going to give Ruth a lot. Our Boaz gives us an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you. And you're being kept for it. And when you come to understand that, grace will make you cry out. Why? And then we come to the heart of the book. Many would say this is the heart of the book. Verse 11 is the background. You've left everything, your people, your land, to come here, which is Abraham. Actually, which is everybody. Every Christian has left. We saw this in the first week. Everything to find God. But here's the key verse, and many would say this is the heart of the book. Look at verse 12. The Lord repay you for what you've done, i.e., coming to him. And a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. Here it is. A foreigner has come to Israel's God seeking asylum, seeking rest, seeking salvation. This is the heart of the book. And it is this, it is exactly this. You've come to take refuge under his wings. It is this that God did for Israel. Have a look at this. Exodus 19. Then you shall say to the house of Jacob, and you shall tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. That is salvation in the Old Testament. God gathered a people under his wings, but they backslid. And here is a foreigner who's trying to nestle in. You don't belong here, but she's trying to nestle in. She's trying to get under those wings. She's seeking asylum in the right place. Remember how we said, seek what you seek, but it's not where you seek it. It's in him. And Jesus came to earth, and he offered that asylum to Israel, to the Jew first. Look what Jesus said. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent in. How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. But you weren't keen. Jesus is saying, I offered you asylum. I try to be your Boaz. But you weren't keen. And so then Jesus turns around and he offers it to the whole world. Look at this verse, and this is for you. He has an offer for you. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Come glean in my field. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. You'll be safe with me. I'll call you son. I'll call you daughter. I won't take from you. I'm gentle, lowly in heart, and you will find the thing that you've been looking for. Rest for your souls. This is the offer of Jesus. He says to us, I am Boaz. And Dwayne, you're making this up? No, because in Boaz's body, right here, is the seed of Jesus Christ. He is the ancestor. It's his great, 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 great grandson who will offer this very thing to you and to me. Jesus says, come glean. All right, so let's close. How can I come under the wings? How can I find asylum? All right, I want to give it a go. I'm going to try this, Jesus. How do I come to him? Well, you've got a sinner's prayer there for you in verse 13. Look, verse 13. Here is a prayer for you. Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord. You have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I'm not one of your servants. There is the sinner's prayer for you. There is everything you need to know about coming to Jesus Christ. Look what she says. I have found favor. You want to come to Jesus on that basis. You want to come to your bigger Boaz and you want to say to him, treat me with grace. Please look upon me and find favor. Find it in your heart to be kind to me. That's what you want to ask. If I have found favor in your eyes, how do you see things, Lord? Won't you see me? And she calls him Lord. This is a inferior seeking help from a superior. There is no coming to Jesus unless you come to him as a superior. If he is your equal, he can't help you until you go down on your knees and acknowledge him to be your Lord. But there's more. Look what she says. If I found grace, Lord, you have comforted me. That's why we go to Jesus. We seek rest. We seek the thing that our hearts are after. Comfort, protection, shelter. He is the one who gives us comfort and rest. Look what she says. You've comforted me. You've spoken kindly to me. You'll never come to Jesus unless you believe that the gospel of Jesus Christ is a kind word. It's not religion. Religion is advice. This is the way you should live your life. The gospel is kindness to you. It's an offer of grace and favor. The gospel says to you, God loves you. God sent his son for you. God made his own son poor so that you can be rich. God sent his son to die. And later on, we'll look at communion. That's why I'm not going to go into the cross too much. But in communion, we'll see that Jesus bore our penalty for us. And then lastly, you've spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. You only can come to God when you come on the basis that you've got no claim. The moment you come to God, put out your hand and say, give me what you owe me, you're disqualified. It's only by coming and saying, I'm not one of your servants. I have forfeited the right to your kindness. Do you believe that? Until you do, you ain't going to get grace. You're not going to be gobsmacked by grace until you understand you've forfeited all claims and you come by grace. And you put it all together, and this is what we see. Those who love God, all things work together for good to bring you to your bigger, better Boaz. That's what it was for. Was it a puncture? Or was it winning the lottery? Both were God. And they're all designed to work together for good, to bring you to your better Boaz every single day. So what must we do? Well, this is our last point. Seek asylum in him. Why don't you let Ruth, here is a vulnerable immigrant, a woman, a widow, poor as you like, bravely goes seeking grace. Why don't you let her instill in you some courage? Why don't you like her? Go seek grace until you find it in the bigger, better Boaz, Jesus Christ. Well, I better end there. Why don't I give you a few moments to pray? Maybe pray silently. Why don't you pray verse 13? And then I'll take a few short questions because we've got communion.